A mai nap első előadója Oroszországból érkezett hozzánk a konferenciára, és ezúton is köszönjük, hogy elfogadta a meghívásunkat. Előadónk Moszkvában ortodox pap és liturgikus szakember. Jelenleg a Moszkvai Teológiai Akadémia, valamint az Orosz Ortodox Egyház doktori és posztdoktori iskolájának professzora, és a Szretyenszki Szemináriumban a liturgikus teológia tanszék vezetője. Tagja szinódusi bizottságoknak, valamint tagja néhány a szlávisztikai tanulmányokkal és történelemmel kapcsolatos tudományos folyóiratoknak. A legtöbb publikációja oroszul jelent meg, körülbelül 200 cikk, de angolul is jelent meg jó néhány magas impaktfaktorú cikke. Most felkérem Mihály Zseltov atyát, hogy tartsa meg előadását, amely az Eukarisztia az Orosz Ortodox Egyház lelkipásztori és liturgikus gyakorlatában címet viseli.
First of all, I wish to express deepest gratitude to His Eminence and all the Hungarian Church for this invitation. This is a great honor to participate in this conference. I'm sorry for speaking in English. I will use this language. I was asked to present a paper on the Eucharist in the Russian tradition. And let me start with the origins of this tradition. The liturgical tradition received by the Russian Church after the baptism of Rus in 988 was of Byzantine origin, but it was not purely Constantinopolitan. Rather, it relied on a corpus of liturgical and patristic translations into Slavonic language made by St. Clement of Ohrid and his co-workers, who were active in the first half of the 10th century in the western Bulgarian lands, in the region of modern Macedonia and Albania. There can be no doubt that the Byzantine formularies of the Eucharistic liturgy held a prominent place in this corpus, just like in the corpus of translations made by St. Cyril and Methodius in the late 9th century, earlier than Clement of Ohrid work, where a prominent place was taken by the versions of Ordinarium and Propria of the Latin Mass. In the oldest extant Slavonic manuscripts, we find partly preserved Slavonic translations of the two Constantinopolitan Eucharistic formularies, that of St. Basil and of St. John Chrysostom, along with translations of different pieces from the Latin sacramentary and from the Jerusalemite formulary of Divine Liturgy ascribed to St. James, brother of the Lord. The proper understanding of the Eucharistic service by the Slavs was safeguarded by a few didactic texts translated by the creators of the Slavonic literacy. These included the set of mystagogical homilies of St. Cyril or John of Jerusalem, a commentary on the Divine Liturgy ascribed to St. Germanos of Constantinople, though in the earliest manuscripts this very commentary is ascribed to St. Basil the Great, actually. Also, Eucharistic miracle stories from the Apophthegmata Patrum, and to this set of, quite a small set of didactic texts, but very important texts, St. Clement of Ohrid added his own homily, which he composed himself, and which is an important witness to the actual perception of the Eucharist by a 10th century Orthodox hierarch and ecclesiastical author. The Eucharistic formularies of St. Basil and of Chrysostom, translated by Clement and his accomplices, contain regular prayers from the Evhologion of Constantinople, supplemented by a number of specific additional ones. Some of these additional prayers, non-Constantinopolitan, are also found in the Greek Evhologia from the southern Italy. Yet some of these prayers seemingly have no Greek prototype. Thus, the oldest stratum of liturgical tradition of the Slavs who were adherent to the Eastern Rite appears to be Western Byzantine, like that of the South Italian Greeks, and not purely Constantinopolitan. When Rus was baptized in the late 10th century, this stratum spread to Rus and formed the initial layer of its own tradition. By the 11th century, the updated version of the Slavonic Evhologion, including the Eucharistic rites, appeared. This time it was verified according to the Constantinopolitan standard. But the oldest stratum of tradition continued to coexist with an updated one, forming a specific old Russian type of the Eucharistic formulary, which was a mixture of two basic liturgical layers, a Western Byzantine and a Constantinopolitan. So I will repeat briefly. The Russians, from the very beginning of the Russian Church, accepted a specific tradition which consisted of a few layers, purely Constantinopolitan liturgy and not purely Constantinopolitan liturgy. And this tradition was further supplemented by additional prayers in the course of the 12th, 13th, 14th centuries, which originated in the private practices of the Middle and Late Byzantine asceticism. So the Russian tradition also has a lot of things to do with the ascetic monastic tradition, including the Eucharist. As for the understanding of the Eucharist in the Old Rus, it was framed by first the Eucharistic formularies themselves. As I'm going to show at length elsewhere, these have adopted, among other things, the homily of Clement of Ohrid, which I mentioned before. But now it was read before every celebration of the Eucharist. So all the Russian priests were having a very specific view on the liturgy, on what they are going to do, because they read before every Eucharist this homily by Saint Clement. And this continued until the 17th century when there was a liturgical reform in Rus. So this formed the priests in a very, you know, specific way and the understanding of the Eucharist. And the understanding of the Eucharist by the Russians was also formed by a selection of short pseudonymous liturgical commentaries, including the one ascribed to St. Germanos or St. Basil, and also other commentaries ascribed to St. Basil and to St. Gregory the Theologian and to St. John. And I have presented an editio principis of the Greek text of the pseudo-Gregorian commentary. The Greek text was seemingly lost, but then found. By the 14th century, these commentaries, together with some other texts, were blended into a united commentary called the Liturgy Interpreted, Толковая служба in Russian. The Liturgy Interpreted, which was included into the Nomokanon. Nomokanon is a sort of Codex Iuris Canonici of the Slavic, also the Greek countries. And so the Russian Nomokanon contained this blended commentary of many pseudonymous and also patristic texts. And it was, you know, official and legal, the legal understanding of the Eucharist until the middle of the 17th century. The actual practice of Eucharistic participation in the Old Rus can be traced from the canonical responses of Kievan metropolitans and other Russian hierarchs. Thus, for the 12th century, we see from the responses of Archbishop Nifont of Novgorod to the questions of Kirik of Novgorod, a priest of his diocese, that ordinary people received communion quite regularly, probably on a weekly basis, or on monthly basis, but regularly. The main requirement for communicants was sexual purity. Those unmarried should not be guilty of any sort of fornication. Those married should abstain from their partners for 2 days, or even just for one single day, if they are newlyweds. So the church even, you know, understood such complications. Save this, an obligatory ablution on the day before communion. This is interesting. I will comment on this. So save the sexual purity and an obligatory ablution on the day before communion, the document does not mention any specific preparatory fast or prayer rule for the communicants. Is it okay now with the speed? Normal? Even more slow? Okay. Pre-Eucharistic ablution mentioned in the old Russian canonical responses may have had some baptismal overtones, since according to the old Russian texts, when you baptize someone, you should always give him communion afterwards. And it could work in the opposite way also. So why necessarily clean yourself before communion? Maybe because of this, but no, who knows? This is just a hypothesis. But this was even confirmed by a synod of the Russian Church in 1274, this obligatory ablution. Interestingly enough, I will just comment, in our times, in modern times, some monks, some Russian spiritual fathers, they say that, on the contrary, one should not clean himself before communion. I don't know for which reason, this is just sort of strange ideas. The actual practice of in the questions of Kyrie of Novgorod, there is though a mention of practice of keeping a penitential fast for 40 days before communion. This fast was kept by those who lived in fornication, actually. And they were thinking of cleansing themselves from fornication for 40 days. This practice is not acceptable according to Nifont. And he says that to the Novgorod, Bishop of Novgorod, and says he says that such people cannot be admitted to communion despite any fast or whatever until they stop living in sin. There are also a few mentions of communion on Easter, which seems to be the day when most of the people were going to participate. Some of them communicated 3 days in a row after Easter, adding to the Easter itself Paschal Monday and Tuesday. So this is the earliest Russian practice. People communicate quite regularly. The only real thing they should do is keeping themselves free from sin, and that's it. Most of the people receive communion on Easter and Nativity. But a little bit later, in the beginning of the 13th century, in the Russian Evhologia, starting with the earliest extant manuscripts of the Synodal Library 604, we found two specific prayers for the communicants, one to be read before Easter, another to be read before Nativity. And it is clear from these prayers that only those were accepted to communion who kept the 40-day fasts before Nativity and before Easter and received these prayers from their spiritual fathers. So this is a very big change in the practice. This contradicts to what we just said about the practice of frequent communion described in the questions of Kyrie of Novgorod. So one should conclude that either there were different practices in Russia. Maybe people of Novgorod, the northern part of Russia, they did it in one way, and the people of the Volyn, the now Ukraine, the southern part, from where this manuscript is originating. Maybe they had another practice. Yes, this is possible, but even better explanation could be that in the 12th century, the hierarchs of the Russian Church, after a sort of a schism, there was a turmoil in the Russian church history in the middle of the 12th century. And afterwards, a few Greek hierarchs came from Byzantium, one by one, and they were adhering to very strict rules of Christian behavior. Maybe because of this, the practice has changed. Who knows? I'm now currently working with my colleague and a very good scholar, Andrei Vinogradov, on a book on the Russian 12th century. Maybe we will write more about this problem. Be it as it may, but in the late 14th century, we now turn to later sources, we already find a very strict practice of admitting to communion the ordinary people. The priests, they communicated on every mass, but just the priests, The ordinary people were kept in a very strict distance from the holy gifts. Thus, in 1395, the Kievan Metropolitan Cyprian wrote a canonical letter from Moscow, including instructions on how and when and in which, what should be the right of giving communion to laymen. According to his letter, in a church building, one can give communion only on Easter and Nativity. And outside of the church building, one can give communion to the sick persons at their homes. Another important detail is that Cyprian mentions the figure of a spiritual father who allows or does not allow one to approach to the communion. So this spiritual father is giving him a prayer, and I have already mentioned such prayers before Nativity and before Easter. And then if a person is worthy, he may receive. And another funny detail, men receive communion in the royal doors in the middle of the church, while women should wait for their turn at the side doors of the sanctuary. In another letter by the same Metropolitan Cyprian, and I would stress that Cyprian was not Russian. He was sort of Byzantine ambassador to Rus. So he was not presenting his strange opinions, but the real pan-Orthodox opinion of that time. He was himself a Bulgarian, but he had very strong ties with Constantinople. So in another letter by the same Metropolitan Cyprian to a Russian hegumen, Athanasios Vysotsky the Elder, the Metropolitan insists on completing the special rule of prayers before communion. So now we have for the first time an attestation of an obligatory and a very long, by the way, very long rule of prayers to be read before communion by a person who wishes to communicate. And these prayers were also read by the priests. So the priests could and should be communicating very often, but they should read a lot of prayers every time. These prayers are none, but are very well known. This is a famous prayer rule, which is known in Greek as Akalothia Tistias Metalipsios. It first appears in the Greek sources in about 12th, 13th century, but in the Slavonic sources exactly in the 14th century, and it was becoming longer and longer. So by the 17th century, it was really long in the Russian tradition. So by the 15th century, we are already having in Rus a very strict, a very harsh Eucharistic discipline. And it will remain normative until the 18th century. So now the second part of my presentation, the classical Russian practice. This was the old sources study. Now the classical practice. By the 17th century, the regular Russian practice of receiving communion was to partake once a year, just once a year, in the Great Lent. And not on Easter, by the way, in the Great Lent, somewhere earlier, before Easter. During the regular fast, the communicants held a week of xerophagia, which literally means unboiled food, dry food, food without boiling, without preparation. But this term was understood by the Russians as strictly vegetarian meals without adding a trace of oil, be them boiled or not, but necessarily eaten cold. So you should have a week of cold vegetarian meals without oil. The process of keeping such a week was called govenia, from blagogovenia, which means awe, reverence. So the week of reverence, of meditation, whatever. During this, during their govenia, the believers tried to attend every church service every day,
And also to read the so-called правильные каноны. Three hymnographical canons. Those who know what it is, it's quite long thing. So three canons a day during the whole week. And in the end of the week, the rule, prayer rule of communion itself. So this is, in fact, a complete book. They should have read a big book of many, many prayers during a week. Besides going to the services. illiterate persons who were unable to read books just repeated the Jesus prayer for thousands of times and made hundreds of bowings instead of reading the prayers. After a week of Govenia, the communicants went to confession before their spiritual father. And there was no guarantee that he would allow everyone to receive communion. So it could happen that you keep such a week and then you said, no, not this year, sorry. So, yeah. Everyone was expected to go to one and the same spiritual father. So there was no chance of, you know, mocking him. Those admitted to participate read finally the lengthy service of Holy Communion early in the morning and then went to the Eucharistic celebration to finally partake of the Divine Sacrament. In such conditions, the perception of the Eucharistic service celebrated on a weekly or in the monasteries and in the cathedrals on a daily basis, so they had daily Eucharist, but no communion. The perception of the Eucharistic service in these conditions could not be any other than highly mystical. Such perception was firmly supported by the liturgy interpreted, a commentary which I mentioned before, where the celebration is presented as an invisible angelic drama, the acts of which follow the earthly liturgical rites. The drama performed by the angels invisibly and which culminates when the angels slaughter the divine child during the priest's Sophonius' Sancta Sanctis. Then it's slaughtered and blood is poured into the chalice. Such apocalyptic interpretation, though, by no means was the only way of speculating on the Eucharist. The acquaintance of the communicants with the pure and authentic biblical theology on the sacraments was safeguarded by the fact that the preparatory prayers before communion included pericopes from the first epistle to Corinthians and from the sixth chapter of the Gospel of John, so which contain, you know, regular biblical theology of the Eucharist. It is also interesting to mention that we find parallels to this practice in the West. For example, in the famous tractate of a Jesuit Spanish theologian of the 16th century, Francisco de Toledo, there is also a chapter, specific chapter concerning layman communion, and it states that a layman should communicate every Easter. It's more or less the same, you know? And they also had some fasts and prayers, and so there are quite parallel developments, actually. And we now, in the last part of my paper, I will show that in our days we also have some parallel development, despite the, you know, the break in the traditions between East and West. The practice of an extremely strict pre-communion fast was so regular that it even entered the Russian Typikon, the Book of Rubrics. There is a specific chapter on a week of strict fast before communion, and despite the liturgical reform of the second half of the 17th century, the appropriate chapter is still in the Russian liturgical typikon. It's still there, even in the most recent editions. Nevertheless, the reform started by Nikon, the Patriarch Nikon in the middle 17th century, brought with it many new ideas. If we are talking about the Eucharist, one should start with shortening the liturgical service itself. So the Eucharistic celebration was shortened. All the non-Constantinopolitan state prayers were removed, finally. The rites of preparatory prayers before communion, the Akolothea, Tisthias, Metallius, also was shortened. And even visually, the rite of Eucharistic celebration was in some way has undergone changes. In order to advocate his reforms and meanwhile to deepen the understanding of the Eucharist by the Russians, Patriarch Nikon published a translation of Nicholas Kabasela's commentary on the Divine Liturgy, which is in fact the best Byzantine treatment of the Eucharistic theology, I think. So Nikon made the first Slavonic translation, not himself, he ordered to make the first Slavonic translation. It was for the first time translated in Slavonic, the commentary of Nicholas Kabasela's on the liturgy. And it was published by Nikon in the course of his reform. But it happened that after deposition of Nikon, who was a Greekophile, he was very fond of the Greeks, not of... you know, of Polish, more Polish cultural influence. So, but when he was removed and defrocked, the cultural interests changed, and the Polish influence through the Ukrainian hierarchs who came to Rus, it was enforced. And due to a powerful impact of the Ukrainian theological school and of the Ukrainian ecclesiastical culture on the Muscovites in the second half of the 17th century, Russian liturgical books of this period began to treat the Eucharistic wars of institution as consecratory, which is against the traditional Byzantine understanding of the, you know, what is has, so it's more or less Catholic, actually. And it even entered the Russian books after the reform of Nikon. The Russian liturgika, the Russian evhologia, contained statements that the holy gifts are consecrated during the wars of institution for a few decades. This and also the Russians changed the due to this influence. They also changed their views on the liturgy of pre-sanctified gifts. There is a specific rite for communicating during the Lent when a priest uses the pre-sanctified body of Christ, the bread, to consecrate chalice and to communicate from both bread and chalice. But the Russians now are communicate only from bread. And chalice is still there, but it is understood as unconsecrated. This is similar to what happened in the Catholic world, because until the 11th century, there was an exactly the same rite for the Good Friday of consecrating the chalice, but after the 12th century, the Roman liturgical books stated that no, it doesn't. It is not consecrated. That if I'm right, now the Good Friday service doesn't even have a chalice, just the host, right? Emma, you don't have a chalice on Good Friday, right? No. So this is more or less happens also to the Russian rites. So now the Russians still differ from the Greeks in this question of the pre-sanctified liturgy. While only the Russian old believers who are keeping the old traditions before the reform, they still believe, as the Greeks do, that the chalice is consecrated. Though there is a movement in the Russian church to review this thing and to return to the pristine Byzantine theology. So the understanding of the Eucharist, the institutional wars, the wars of institutions as consecratory, provoked a big scandal, and this is in the liturgy. It is known as хлебопоклонная ересь, the heresy of adoring the still unconsecrated bread. And this lasted in the 1670s, 1680s, until the issue was resolved in the 1690, with stress in the consecratory power of the epiclesis. Though, as so, the Russians returned to the standard Byzantine thinking. Though the pre-sanctified, as I mentioned, is still, you know, treated in a more Catholic way. Another example of Latin influence is an instructive chapter called "Известие учительное," in English, exemplary statement, which was introduced into the Russian liturgicon in the 1670s and was corrected after this heresy, this scandal, in the 1690s. So this chapter is also still there in the Russian liturgical editions of Liturgikon. The text of this chapter is a reworking of didactic rubrics from the Evhologion prepared by and published by the Kievan Metropolitan Peter Mogila in Kiev in 1646. The Muscovites seem to be completely unaware of the fact that Peter Mogila translated most of these rubrics from Latin. So these are rubrics of a Latin Missal, Missale Romanum. And they are in the Russian Liturgikon. A few people actually know it. Among them were two directives, which in an obvious way contradicted to the extra rigorous Eucharistic discipline which the Russians were used to before. One of these rubrics prescribed the altar boys to communicate often, not rarely. Another rubric told that a week length of Govenia is not obligatory and that 3 days of fasting or even just one day will suffice. Besides that, the late 17th century Russian editors of the Liturgikon also introduced there a short chapter concerning daily reading of the canons, the hymnographical canons. According to this chapter, instead of reading three canons a day during a whole week before communion, one could just read the three canons once. All this was foreshadowing strong changes to come in the Russian Eucharistic piety. So the communion became more closer to the people, to the ordinary people. Less fasting, less canons, less everything. But the most significant move in this direction was made by Tsar Peter the Great, who ordered that every Christian Orthodox citizen of the Russian Empire should communicate at least once a year. One should understand that before Peter the Great, many people did not communicate even once a year due to fornication scenes, whatever. And here, everyone should do this and should present a document, a certificate to his authority that he did it. So everyone who was working on civil service, in the military service, should present a certificate of communicating this year. Such measures were justified by a struggle with the old believer's schism which struck the Russian church. Another measure was a consolation of the institution of spiritual fathers. Now, from the times of Peter the Great, the Russian Orthodox Christians should go to confessions not to a specific spiritual father, but to the priest of their parish they were ascribed to. This priest and no one else. So, because this priest was the person who was in charge of issuing such certificate. So he is the person in charge. And the priest himself, he should also write to his bishops the names of those who did not come this year, in order to find out if they are schismatics or whatever. Maybe secret Catholics? No, not Catholics. Old believers was the problem, not the Catholics. Many people who otherwise carelessly did not go to communion for years were now obliged to change their attitude. This, however, didn't turn the Eucharist into the center of spiritual life of the Russian Orthodoxy. This was sort of discipline, but not center of spiritual life. This happened only later. During the period of the Russian Empire, the extra rigorous practice of older times survived only among the old believers. Ordinary Orthodox Christians did not keep a week of xerophagia anymore, enjoying the Lenten, but now hot food. The first Saturday of the Great Lent became the regular day of annual communion for most of the people. So most of the people communicate on the first Saturday of Lent. The people kept the first week of the Lent, communicated, and many thereafter ceased to keep the Lent until Easter. Those who were most pious kept the whole Lent and then communicated once again on the Holy Thursday, the day of the mystical supper, the Last Supper of the Lord. No one at all, save the celebrating clergy, was expected to partake during the pre-sanctified liturgy. This could be explained by theological uncertainties I have mentioned before. And also no one was expected, save the clergy, was expected to communicate on Easter, despite its significance as the day of communion in the medieval times. Now, the complete impossibility of communicating on Easter was understood, came explained that communion was strongly associated with fast, penitence, sadness, whatever, self-humiliation. But Easter is a feast, and one should not, you know, do this on a feast. And this was also a feast which, in the Russian way of life, included excessive drinking of alcohol with the risk of vomiting afterwards. And therefore, you should not also communicate on this day. The Paschal service should be conducted quickly and lively, without the need of interrupting it for confessions and without tolerating long queues of communicants. So the Easter was a day with no communion, actually. Outside of the Great Lent, virtually nobody went to communion. They had liturgy every day, but no communicants, except the day of his or her patronal saint. This was the day when a person could do this because of his saint. There were some exceptions, though, especially among the monks, when this or that pious monk or a layman dared to communicate during each of the four long lasting fasting periods of the year, or even on a monthly basis. Theologically, the Eucharist during the times of the Russian Empire was understood more or less in the terms of the Roman Catholic scholasticism, corrected in this and or that way in order to fit the Byzantine Orthodox liturgical tradition and practice. The apocryphal commentaries of visionary character have been mostly forgotten now. The Eucharist itself was understood as an essential part of church dogmatic, but personal participation in it was much more a question of private piety than a means of building the ecclesiastical community. And the ecclesiastical communities in the imperial period, they were just part of the state. It was the state who was in charge of the church life, not the people. So everything was working, very good, dogmatic, but no, you know, no feeling of communal life. And now I should turn to the last part of my paper, but I already have used all the time. Can I do this? Okay, the changes brought by the 20th century, which is, you know, the most important thing for us now. The religious revival of the so-called Russian Silver Age in the very beginning of the 20th century brought it with it many ideas, among them the renewed attitude towards the Eucharist. Another very important development was the great advance in scholarly studies, including liturgical history, made by such great Russian scholars as Nikolai Krasnoseltsev, Alexei Dmitrievsky, Ivan Karabinov, and others. The religious revival of the Russian Silver Age was mostly only intellectual, and it was strongly colored by Romanticism. Let me quote a famous verse written by a great Russian poet, Osip Mandelstam, in 1915. "Here is the pattern, like a golden sun, a blessed moment in the air it stands. The world is held in time like apple in one's hands. Here will be heard only the Gretchen tongue." And I omit a little. "Like noon eternal is the Eucharist. All drink the cup, all play and sing aloud. Before the eyes of all, the cup of God pours with the gaiety that can't desist." So it's very romantic and highly understood. Another great Russian poet, Alexander Blok, wrote other poems, I'm omitting them in order to save time, also on about the liturgy, its mystical overtones, its symbolism, and so on. So great Russian poets were interested in religion and the liturgy of the church. But it is very characteristic that neither Mandelstam, nor Bloch, nor other poets were actually living active ecclesiastical life. They were not doing it. They were just writing poems. They beheld the powerful symbolism of the Eucharist, but had very little experience of the sacrament itself, as was the case for most of the nominal Russian Orthodox people of that period. The turning point of everything and for everyone was the Russian Revolution of 1917. Initially, the poets and thinkers understood the revolution as a powerful mark of the upcoming revival of the Russian spirit. So they were expecting something good of it. The same Alexander Blok even wrote a poem called The Twelve, where he is matching a gang of revolutionary sailors with none other than the 12 apostles. And the poem ends as follows. Behind them, this gang of bandits actually, behind them follows the hungry dog. Ahead of them with bloody banner, unseen with the blizzard's swirl, safe from any bullet's harm, with gentle step above the storm, in the scattered pear like snow, crowned with a wreath of roses white, ahead of them goes Jesus Christ. So very... But very soon the Russian people found out that instead of revival, and instead of ending of the civil war in the West, they got the humiliating peace treaty with Germany, the civil war in Russia itself, the rejection of territories, and finally the terrible terror of the new communist government directed towards virtually everyone. Religion was proclaimed a relic of the past and was to be eradicated, completely eradicated. Already in 1918, another great Russian poet, Sergei Yesenin, felt this new feeling as follows. I will not fear the doom, nor the spears, nor the arrows of rains. So proclaims, according to the Bible, the prophet Yesenin Sergei, his name. My time has already come. I am not afraid of the clank of the knout. The body of Christ, I spit out of my mouth. So very rude, actually, words. The communists imprisoned and executed thousands and thousands of the Orthodox clergymen and laymen. The ecclesiastical hierarchy was nearly completely destroyed. And in these conditions, the Eucharist finally became what it should be, the center of life and of a Christian community. But now it was often celebrated, not in beautifully decorated, splendid churches, but in prison cells and on wooden stems in the forests around the concentrating camps. Those who escaped imprisonment gathered together in private houses or in sparse churches that have not been requisitioned by the state. In such circumstances, the Eucharist truly became the center of the spiritual life, finally. The similar developments happened in the Russian emigrant circles. But the strict preparation rules still remained. During most of the 20th century, the Russian way of going to communion was keeping a 3 days fast, attending services during this period, and reading three canons during the period of fast, finally going to confessions, and reading the Akolothi of Holy Communion. After the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia and other countries of the former Soviet state experienced a decade of strong spiritual rebirth. Yet the rules of preparation to communion I have just described still remained very much active. In our days, there are still some places where, for example, the Orthodox clergy refuses to administer the Holy Communion during the Easter service, still. And there are many places where they insist on keeping 3 days fast always before communion, but not everywhere. On par with this old practice is now very much widespread in the Russian Church, a different approach based primarily on the works of Nikolai Afanasyev and Alexander Schmemann. Here it is necessary to make a short reservation. Schmemann is often considered almost as a prophet in the Orthodox world. But in fact, one can easily discover that the views of Schmemann are highly dependent on the views of Gregory Dix, an Anglican scholar, who in his turn was an influential theologian, but by no means a pioneer. His work, The Shape of the Liturgy, was on the one hand a continuation of the studies of earlier Anglican liturgical scholars associated with the so-called High Church. On the other hand, Dix's book was an Anglican response to the developments inside the Roman Catholic liturgical movement. Therefore, ideas of Schmemann and other representatives of the Paris school concerning the Eucharist betray strong influence of the Western and mostly Roman Catholic and partly Anglican thinking on the subject. Nowadays, in the crowded parishes of Moscow, St. Petersburg, and other large Russian cities, many people partake of the holy gifts very often, judging by the old standard, not judging by the Catholic standard of daily communion, but often means weekly or in 2 weeks, once in 2 weeks, which is very often in comparison with the older Orthodox standard. but it's very rare according to the modern Catholic standard. In the 2015, the Council of All Bishops of the Russian Orthodox Church issued an official document entitled On the Participation of Christians in the Eucharist. So we have now an official document of the Russian Church, of the Council of Bishops. This document recommends to go to communion frequently, and it speaks of the optional character of preparatory fasting and of reading canons before the liturgy. Even confessions in this document are proclaimed optional for those who have a spiritual father and have received his blessing for communicating without confessions. Only two things are still required in an ordinary situation. First, abstaining from any food and drink from midnight until communion, or at least for 6 hours before communion, more than the Catholics have, and abstaining from marital relations on a day and a night before communion, and reading the Akolithia of Holy Communion, but only for those who are literate and can do this. The shepherds of the church rejoice at the heart when they see how many people approach the Holy Cup in our days. There is, however, a reverse side of this process. The omnipresent spirit of consumerism has entered the ecclesiastical life as well. People like when they are given something, even in a church, when they are given something in a church, be it a holy water, a candle, or communion. But they are much less interested in faith, in asceticism, in the deeds of mercy, in participation in the life of community. Many, now you can see, when you go to a big parish in Moscow, for example, you will always see on Sunday service a lot of parents with their small children, and parents lead their children to communion, hoping that this will help in their upbringing. But at the same time, these parents themselves never communicate or never live their Christian life. So this is a bad side. During the evening services, when there is no communion in our tradition, but when there are read and sang many beautiful biblical passages and Christian hymns, one finds in the church much fewer praying people than during the communion service. Therefore, people often do not understand that though Holy Communion is probably the most important tool of spiritual life, it remains just a tool and not the only content of this life. And the shepherds of the church do not explain them, either because of the lack of time or because of the insufficient understanding of this of themselves, the priests themselves. So conclusion. I finally came to conclusion. In its thousand-year history, the Russian Church has come a long way, also with regard to the Eucharist. For many centuries, it considered the Eucharist more from the mystical and ascetic perspective. But in the late 19th and in the 20th century, it made a great contribution to the understanding of the Eucharist due to the works of the great Russian liturgists and theologians of that times. In particular, the theologians of the Russian immigration had a decisive influence on the movement for the revival and transformation of the Eucharistic life throughout the Orthodox Church in general. Today, the Russian Church undoubtedly undergoes a Eucharistic revival, although it is also associated with certain diseases of growth, above all, an overly individualistic attitude to the Eucharist, an overly individualistic, and also consumeristic, maybe. A recognition of the fact that the Eucharist is not just one of the sacraments of the Church, but the center of the whole life of every Christian church community, which cannot be limited only to ritual activity, is a prerequisite for the further spread of Christian mission in Russia and beyond. That's it. Thank you.